thank you, Professor Gavin Clark, and honorable scholars present here. I'm really honored to present myself here to speak something on Noble Man in this lecture. So, in this lecture, I'll specifically speak on the language and methodology used by the Navanayayikas, just beginning from the concept of Padarthas as it has been taken from the Vaisheshika philosophies, as you all know. But the background of this sort of methodology adopted by Navanayayikas also needs to draw our attention. In Indian tradition, creating human database and communicative skill through artificial language have been the central theme of philosophical analysis for more than thousands of years. This tradition happens to be Veda-oriented as well as it is linguistically strongly grounded on well-formulated grammatical rules by Panini. Now, Veda itself being a text or knowledge codified required verification from time to time regarding authenticity of its content and its implication and or relevance in human society. Knowledge was transferred directly from the teacher to the pupil, opening the door towards worldly life for achievement in socio-political sphere and also in persona or spiritual development. In fact, Veda and Vyakarana were the ancient most orally inscribed texts. Four-dimensional goals of life, known as Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha, were designated as Purushartha. Purusharthas were practiced within four-graded lifestyle known as Chaturashrama. Now this Chaturvarga, Chaturashrama and Chaturvarna Vyavastha were the pillars of Hindu society as an unique socio-religious system in which the principle of self-harmony and the principle of harmony with others, that is, subhumans, other humans and superhumans, construed a value system unique of its kind. Now to look at this Chaturashrama system, you'll find Brahmacharya was the time while someone was supposed to live with the teacher's family to learn the Shastras, the texts in original, and it was the age limit fixed there were 5 years to 18 years. In the next stage, Garhasthya, he has to join back to main family stream in socio-cultural purview, and the age limit was fixed as 18 years to 50 years. And in the third grade, it was Vanaprastha, that is, retirement from family life at home and adaptation of spiritual life, and the age limits fixed there was 50 years to 65 years. And the fourth and the final was Sannyasa, a renunciation of all worldly affairs and exclusive spiritual practices. The age limit fixed there was 65 years onwards. There are some exceptions also who went directly to Sannyasa from Brahmacharya. Now this four-graded lifestyle was practiced in a social system with mutual classification on the ground of individual capacity. Four classes were Brahmana, the teaching group, Kshatriya, the administrative group, Vaishya, the business group, and Shudra, the commoners who do not belong to other three classes. In general, Tattvajnana or knowledge of truth about this world was considered to be the prime cause towards achievement of the Purusharthas, especially Moksha. Hence, what is Tattvajnana, how can it be acquired, how can it be communicated without any ambiguity? These questions became main concerns of the philosophers related to the cult. Theoretical discourses made by them required a methodological approach to discover their universal character or make them universally applicable to most of the human thinking pattern, irrespective of cult, creed, or religion. Now, Indian model of philosophical analysis, technically devised by the neologicians, that is known as Nobunaga school, places forth a Prama-oriented picture of the world or Vishwa, the whole. This world features four basic constituents stated as number one, Pramata, the knower, number two, Prameyo, the knowables, number three, Pramana, the process of knowing, and number four, Pramiti, the knowledge achieved by the Pramana. Nothing in this world are left out of these broad categories, that is, each and every entity in this world must find its place in any of those characters noted above. To speak more specifically, all the worldly entities must fall either under the category of Prameya, the knowables, or under Pramana, the process of knowing. In fact, while we speak or even think about the process of knowing, Pramana also happens to fall under the category of Prameya. Hence, to take a definite look into this character, Prameya was of utmost importance for the Indian philosopher to get a clear picture of this world. Primarily, the world was conceptualized as Vishwa, or a whole, observed as Vastu, a totality of entities existing. Vastu, being object of cognition, was conceptualized as Vishaya. Vishaya, with its functional role, was conceptualized as Karaka. Thus, all the entities in this world were captured in these three significant status as Vastu, Vishaya, and Karaka. Neologicians utilized the Vaisheshika theory of Padartha, since this world appeared to be not only a Prameya, but also to be Abhidheya, that is, verbalizable, which was also accepted by all the other philosophical schools. Vatsayana gives us the definition very clearly as Jnayatvam Abhidheyatvam Cha Padartha Samanya Lakshanam. That is, knowability and verbalizability is the universal definition for Padartha in general. Practically, knowability and verbalizability are two basic properties of this world of our experience, and virtually our experiences tell us how we know and how we express our experiences through language or try to communicate with others. Neologicians mark the process of knowing as encoding, that is, internalization of the external world. In Sanskrit, that is known as Jnana Vishayikarana, while the process of verbal expression was marked as decoding or Shabda Vyavahara. Before I go into details of these two processes of encoding and decoding, a holistic picture of this world as Padartha following the neologicians are given here. Number one, the world has been perceived as Dharma Dharmi Bhava, that is, Dharma or the property, and Dharmi, the locus of that property and their specific relation, construes this world. Number two, this world is basically Prama oriented, that is, a Prameya. How is it that Prama keeping in the center stage, all the entities are to be categorized either as Prameya, that is, knowable, or Pramata, or the knower, or the Pramana, or the process of knowing, or the experiences gained through this process, that is, Pramiti. Virtually, verbalizability and knowability together makes Padartha, or this world as a whole, for them. Now, in another scheme, you'll find that this world or Padarthas have been categorized as internal, that is, Antara, or external, that is, Bahya. Among the internal or Antara Padarthas, or the world specified like that, you'll find sukha, dukha, icha, dvesha, prayatna, dharma, adharma, sanskara, and jnana. And in the vahya or the external world, we'll find all the other objects of sensual experiences, that as we mean to say, all external objects. The fourth picture comes as, this world or the padartha can be categorized broadly in two categories. One is bhava padartha and the other is abhava padartha. The bhava padarthas are positive entities divided into dravya, guna, karma, samanya and vishesha. The six categories there. And the seventh one is the abhava padartha. And subcategories of this abhava padartha or negative entities are sansarga and sansarga bhava and ananya bhava. We'll speak on this in details later. Let's start with dravyas, a substance. There are of nine types, that is prithvi or earth, ap or water, tejas or fire, vayu or air, akasha, that is space, kala, that is time, dik, that is dimension, atman, that is self, and manas, that is mind. Gunas or qualities are of 24 types, that is rupa or form, then rasa, gandha, sparsha, sankhya, parimana, prithaktva, sanyoga, vibhaga, paratva, aparatva, gurutva, dravatva, sneha, shabda, buddhi, sukha, dukha, icha, dvesha, prayatna, dharma, adharma, and sanskara. Karmas, that is action or dynamics, are of five types. Utshepana, that is upward motion, abakshepana, that is downward motion, akunchana, that is contraction, prasarana, that is expansion, and gamana, that is linear motion. Samanya or universal property are of two types, that is para, extensive type, and apara, exclusive type. In later stage we also find an intermediary category, that is parapara, something in between para and apara. The next one is samavaya. This is a kind of relation by inherence. This is a single type. The sixth bhava padartha is vishesha or individual. These are innumerable but with single exclusive character. In Sanskrit they have been qualified as, stated as padartha vibhajaka or itara vyavartaka. And to note here that these special kind of concept, that is vishesha, gives the name for the vaisheshikas who deals specifically with this quality or this type of padartha. Now let's go to the abhava padarthas. The first one I have already said, the sansarga abhava, that is negation of contact or relation. That's of three types. One is prak, that is non-existence of an entity available prior to its creation. The second one is pradvamsa, that is non-existence of an entity due to its destruction. And atyanta, that is eternal non-existence of entities. And the second category of abhava padartha is ananya bhava, that is mutual non-existence of specific properties that introduces difference or bheda between padarthas. This is of single type. Now, all the bhava padarthas are regarded as pratiyogin or counter-positive in context of abhava or negation or absence of them. In case of relation and analogy also, concept of counter-positive is accepted, without which they cannot be at all realized. These three padarthas, namely absence, relation and analogy, from this point are designated as sapratiyogika, that is counter-positive dependent characters. Thus, the world or Padartha can be categorized in various methods as we experience it. Now, this process of knowing and the process of expressing that experience have also been formulated by the neologicians in a foolproof method applicable universally. The process of knowing or internalization or encoding has been termed as jnana visharikarana padhyati, that is, objectification in a cognitive behavior. Internalization requires a link up with the external world, and manas, the sole internal sense organ or antarendriya, often referred as mind, plays the role successfully, though there is a vertical difference between the Western concept of mind and Indian concept of manas or antahkarana. Manas, being an unconscious entity, needs to be initiated to act by some conscious agent, as it happens in the case of a rolling stone. Initiative necessary for this process of internalization is made at core by Atman, the eternal conscious Padartha, delimited by physical bodies of all beings. In the case of internal experiences, the structure happens to be different in the sense that the external sense organs stay inert at the time, like as our state of dream, or maybe in some silent experiences which we just enjoy or go through. All the knowable Padarthas inevitably are nameable, that is, avidheya, referred by name or meaningful culture-specific sounds in cognitive structures. Neologicians during 1000 AD to 600 AD appropriated the quadrilateral epistemological structure prevalent in post-Vedic period, that is in 4th century BC approximately, from the text Gautamiya Nyaya Sutra. This structure involved cognitive processes like pratyaksha, that is perception, anumana, that is inference, upamana, that is analogy, and shabda, that is verbal testimony. All these four processes of internalization have been well defined by the neologicians too, to justify that different types of knowledge should be accepted according to their specific sources and originations. Apart from that, they also mentioned that it is only in the case of perception that the knower happens to be in direct contact with the knowable, while for the rest of the four, the knower is bound to take resort to some other types of knowledge originated prior to that particular piece of knowledge. On this ground, knowledge can be characterized as either immediate or non-immediate, though the knowable remains unaffected by the process of knowing. The following graph would make the formulation clear. So if you look at this, while someone has some experience of a pot, virtually the total structure remains to be the pot and the potness, that is the universal quality that it has, and the samavaya relation between the potness and pot. This is the worldly objective structure. But in cognitive pattern, when we go to perception, a pratyaksha, you will find on your right hand side that indriya, that is the sense organs, and the artha, that is the object, comes into direct contact and produces immediate knowledge. But in rest of the three, beginning with inference, analogy, and testimony, there are always an intermediary cognitive state or jnana that leads to the final state of experience, like inference or analogy or testimony. Now, validity of a knowledge thus oriented through other valid knowledge or information exhibits its natural or conventional power to reveal the reality or truth involved in the process. All the properties or characters in such cognitive structures are noted as pravritti nimitta, that is, administering one's motivation towards both cognitive and linguistic behavior. A statement by a modern philosopher sounds to be quite relevant in this perspective, as language maps reality. Actually, language performs the function of encoding reality as experienced. Hence, it may also be stated as a sentence is an encoded cognition. The cognition might be true or false, but the sentence unfolding the reality must follow the structure encoded. At the same time, neologicians put their hands on the rule that description of the structured reality must follow logical economy. Now, let's concentrate on a sentence is an encoded cognition on this form. The neologician language and methodology preserve this purpose of logical economy, as I have already said, on expressing one's experience by way of introducing notions of, number one, co-referentiality. In Sanskrit, in Nobuna language, is called nirupaka bhava, and number two, delimitation. In Nobuna language, is called avachhedya avachhedaka bhava. This led to avachhedakatavada, regarded as most relevant stimulant in artificial language and cognitive behavior. Now, look at their methodology, how they have fixed up the co-referential terms available in this world of experience, like dharma and dharmin, that is quality and the property and its locus, adhar and adheya, that is locus and the locati, vishesha and visheshana, the qualified and the qualifier, avachhedya and avachhedaka, delimited and the delimiter, vachya and vachaka, the speakable and the speaker, grahya and grahaka, expressor and the expressed. This term is specifically has been very much used by the Patanjala Yoga Darshana. Avayava and avayavin, karana and karya, and so on. There are at least 26 such terms available in Nobuna methodology, universally used by all the philosophical schools whenever they express their own philosophical concepts. So far, we have spoken about encoding cognition and linguistic behavior immersed in the knower or pramata. But any kind of speech act naturally involves the process of decoding, leaving significant space for understanding or interpretation by the hearer. In fact, the same person acts as a hearer to gain the status of a genuine speaker. The process of decoding is termed as shabdabodha prakriya, that is, understanding a sentence in the tradition. The knower cum speaker attempts to express his encoded cognition with specific content or vishaya. The will to express his experience leading to his attempts for uttering a sentence is coined as intention or tatparya. It has been defined as bhaktur icha tatparyam, as the will of the speaker is called tatparya. The speaker, in fact, intends to expose his world of experience to the hearer. Hence, the role of tatparya is thought to be utmost important, playing significant role in speech act. And there are a lot of debates between the philosophers, especially with the Mimamsakas and the Nayayika schools in this regard, that how this tatparya can be expressed while if there is no speaker. You know, the Purva Mimamsakas doesn't care for a particular speaker. They take the text to be the genuine one to reveal the meaning in itself. So if there is no speaker at all, how can the tatparya can be excluded from there? That's the problem. Three more factors have been admitted in the tradition to carry out non-ambiguous communication. They are akanksha or anupurvi, that is syntactic coordination. Number two, yagata, or semantic or syntactic compatibility. And number three, asati, that is syntactic proximity. Now we'll go for the shabdabodha prakriya or the structure of cogito linguistics as it goes through certain steps, as you'll find at least six. In step one, you'll find the words syntactically unrelated with their meanings attached. The upper level unmarked ones A, B, C and D represents the words. They are syntactically unrelated, and downwards you will find marked A, marked B and marked C and marked D. They mean the meanings attached to those words. In step 2, the words syntactically gets related, that means they make a string at the time with their meanings attached to syntactically related words previously. In step 3, we'll find words syntactically related, that is, had formed a string, but variety of meanings emerged out of syntactically well-formed referential words in a sentence. That is, you may find that a word gives us more than one meanings. So from there, how can one go for a certain specific meaning to catch the tatparya or the intended meaning? So we have to go to the step 4, where you will find syntactically well-formed words in a string and eliminating the non-intended meanings and focusing on the specified, verified meaning only. In step 5, you will find syntactically well-formed words formed in a string. They are related to intended meanings, and those meanings have been then related within themselves. They have formed a relation within themselves. And in step 6, finally, you will find only the meanings related in the cognitive state of the hearer that makes understanding or interpretation following speaker's intention. This is the Shabdabodha Prakriya as illustrated in the text, and in graph you may find it like this. Now, to keep away all sorts of ambiguity, thus neologicians have presented the logical process of decoding as well as have formed an artificial language suitable both to philosophical and poetic or aesthetic application. Difference between the two is that a poet enjoys limitless freedom in expressing his world of experience, while a philosopher has to restrict himself within the world given to him. But for both of them, successful communication is possible only when the hearer can follow the speaker's intention word specifically, not beyond that. Thus, Indian intellectual tradition bearing a text-based culture for millenniums have developed an analytic model to preserve its sanctity and assurance to proper understanding and learning through a universal method with a vision to the highest welfare of the world. this teaching or learning method at the same time, though pedagogical in the true sense of it, is still relevant in awarding a society where shastras or traditional instructive texts are highly valued to keep up the social structure in India throughout the passage of time immemorial. And this much for this lecture today. In the next lecture, we'll go for the process of decoding in a more detailed way, how they scan a sentence to take out the meanings attached to them at every nodal point. That's all for now.
Thank you.
Yes, now, if any queries.
Your last slide, you had the six stages. The final stage,
yes,
you had the elimination of syntactically well-formed words in a string. I didn't understand why that gets eliminated.
Because some more, for that you'll have to go to step three, where you'll find that a number of meanings may emerge according to the sanskara of the hearer. Say, like, bring me a page. Now, this word page may mean a strip of paper or maybe a little boy serving. Now, how will you take up the meaning what I really intend to mean? Whether I am requesting you to bring me a piece of paper or a little boy. So, you have two meanings in your hands. Now, which one you will choose, which one you will select? Now, through this selective process, you will have to eliminate one. Mm-hmm. And you will have to decide by yourself, taking in consideration of the context. That if in library, while writing something, if someone is requested to bring a page, that means he needs a paper. But on other works for like to help him or serve him like that, then might be some little boy he wants to get. So there is a matter of selection and elimination in some stage of understanding or cogito-linguistic behavior. So in that way, when you find that after this elimination round, selection and elimination round, you have formed on a certain meaning, that is, you have a confirmation of meaning, then you take those meanings and get them related in step 5. And then in 6, in your mind, in your buddhi or intellect, you only have those related meanings that makes the state of understanding or interpretation.
And follow up to that, was actually the same question I was going to ask. But I was just wondering whether the elimination of non-intended meanings, is that always only a cognitive process, or does it happen sometimes in a dialogue or discussion? Or like, is this only sort of an internal...
The dialogue or...
Like, I'm just thinking, even in terms of the textual tradition, it seems like a commentary, for example, you'd have a sutra and a commentary, and it seems mm-hmm. that a commentary would actually partly serve to eliminate non-intended meanings. And I'm mm-hmm. just wondering whether that fits into this framework, or whether this is only sort of something that would happen in one's mm-hmm. own buddhi. Mm-hmm.
You see, if someone concentrate or confirm the meaning following the context mm-hmm. or the intention of the speaker or the writer, considering his background, why he is saying these things, only then he can have the proper interpretation. Mm. Otherwise, the case happens to be of a misinterpretation or misunderstanding.
To get the elimination of non-intended meanings, don't you have to go outside of the syntactically well-formed words?
Yes.
You do have to go outside
yes.
of that, don't you? Yeah.
No, you need not go out of it. You need not go. Because you see that there are polysemous words which gives us meanings more than one.
Mm. Oh yeah, but to get a specification of this meaning as opposed to that meaning, You'd have to refer to extra linguistic factors, wouldn't you? Like,
What do you mean by extra linguistic factor?
Bring me the page, as it were. I would like to see it. You'd have to refer to the wants or the whatever of the person, the intentions and so on. Perhaps not extra linguistic, perhaps that's the wrong word, or the context in which the statement is made.
Yes.
It seems you'd have to go outside of that particular syntactic ignore form of words in a string, that particular string. You couldn't. You'd have to refer to other
no.
texts.
Yes, it's the text. And you see, from the step one, what we're doing, we get some words which are not syntactically related. Then we get the relation between them while they form the string. Then in third step, from those words syntactically related on the in string, we can have varieties of meanings. It can be reduced. So on step four, we have to reduce it for confirmation of meaning. This is nothing extra linguistic.
Okay.
This is a total linguistic behavior.
And we reduce it by other kinds of sentences.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a question that's maybe slightly unrelated, but still related. You're speaking about the sort of four different methods of gaining knowledge, shabda and inference, etc., etc.
Yes.
And I was wondering about particularly shabda.
Yes.
How shabda and pratyaksha relate to each other, or in terms of perhaps a hierarchy. For example, if pratyaksha and shabda are in disagreement on an issue or on a question, would pratyaksha take precedence over shabda, and if so, sort of what kind of process works there?
In case of processing, one has to get the perception of shabda first. One have to hear the sound. That's also kind of a perception.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So after perception of this kind of sounds, the sounds produces another cognitive state that is known as padartha smarana. Okay, that is remembering the padartha related to that. So in that second state you will get the sound heard and the meaning remembered and the fixed relation between them. And then in the third stage, you will get the meaning only. Now, this total thing that is pada jnana, that is cognition of pada, padartha jnana, that is cognition of the padartha, and sambandha jnana, that is the cognition of the their relation, makes a total programming. That is known as shabda pramana. Okay, this is a distinctive feature of this pramana. But you see, the final cognitive state, though it's a jnana, it has to occur, it has to be based upon three other cognitive states behind it, or more to say four actually. Is the perception of the sound is also as behind. So beginning from there, he will have the padagana and the padarthagana and the samandhagana, and then the final state of pramana that makes him the confirmed knowledge, confirmed belief or knowledge, that is shabda pramana. So there is no disagreement between the two. Actually, it's a kind of series of cognitive states that makes the final state, final stage
So then shabda in this case is really referring specifically to sound, to utterance.
Yes.
Okay.
It begins with that.
Okay.
That's why often perception is called the jyeshtha pramana, the eldest one
mm-hmm.
of all the pramanas.
Some schools don't accept
yes.
shabda, don't
yes.
testimony. Some other schools don't accept the fourth pramana, the
mm-hmm.
shabda,
yes.
As being valid.
Mm-hmm.
The,
as aparaksha? Do you mean shabda aparaksha?
Yes.
Yes. There is another concept that is specifically teamed up by Advaita Vedantins,
mm.
the Shabda Parakshavada, that is the Mahavakyas or the sentences that reveals the identity between Jiva and Brahma. It often so happens that it begins at a lower level while you hear it, and after practicing that hearing, when your ignorance destroys virtually, then finally that Brahma itself expresses Swata Prakasha Swapramana Aparaksha, that is immediate expression of Brahman happens there. So there is no instrument before that expression of Brahman is found except that Shabda or Mahabhakyas, the sentential cognitions. And the function, actually the function of the sentential cognition in that case is actually destruction of maya or avidya. So as soon as this is destroyed, the swata pramana or self-expressive brahmani comes off. That is shabda paraksha, in fact. And this is the only case that shabda can deliver immediate knowledge of something as Brahman.
Mm.
And should shabda be understood as distinct from Shruti?
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Very distinct.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the same.
Oh, it's the same.
It's the same.
It's the same. Because
mm.
then, I mean, when you have a school like the Mamsikas who would then, you know, basically place emphasis on the authority of the Shruti,
yes.
then it seems that there is a possibility for Pratyaksha and Shruti to sometimes. I'm asking because I'm looking right now at Jyoti Shastra and instances where there's a lot of discussions looking at the stars and seeing differences between what's happening in the stars and what texts say should be happening. And there's, you know, difficulty because what happened, how do you understand, how do you reconcile that when
yes.
these texts are supposed to be Shruti,
mm-hmm.
but observation doesn't
mm-hmm.
agree.
Mm-hmm. But the main tool there happens to be inference.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is connecting two state of affairs
uh-huh.
together, that you are looking at something, movements and all these things,
yeah.
and then you are getting the results, movements, and their results is supposed to be so.
Uh-huh.
You learn that from the Shastra.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you go for inferring that
if and only if
I find this thing in such a position,
mm.
that means it may give the results like this.
Uh-huh.
But there might be some vadhakas or some sort of, what should I say? There might be some extra conditions invading inside,
yeah.
making the result not desirable, not so much desirable, not that much desirable or like that. That makes Jyotish Shastra sometimes fallible.
Yeah.
It must be the extreme example of where you've got dealing with the external world, and yet
yes.
the whole process, the
yes.
analysis you're talking about is internalization.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying
it's,
to sort of
it's
out, yeah.
right at the other extreme, isn't it? Where a Western mind would analyse the outer world in such analytical detail, we're not used to internalising in this tradition,
mm-hmm.
where everything is analysed in the finest, subtlest detail. I think that's one of the reasons why probably it's not taken up in a Western sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much like in the Buddhist tradition, isn't it, where the meditation is so
and
complex and there's so many sort of numerical analyses. I was interested to see your twos, your threes, and your always the four is the holistic way of totalizing the analysis.
These things. These two principles, principle of coreferentiality and principle of delimitation, for getting almost perfect confirmation of knowledge or linguistic behavior.
I was interested in your emphasis on manas, which is usually the sort of sixth sense. Rather than buddhi, as the sort of synthesis, you know, in the Sankhya, it's the link between Purusharam, Prakriti.
Yes, but this is the Nobunaga's follow the Vaisheshika model of padarthas, and their manas is the ninth
is
padartha.
It?
It's a distinctive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a buddhi is a guna padartha.
Yes.
That resides in Atman, relative to Atman.
Mm.
I think I just thought about something that one of my problems with this system is that it seems to be a closed system.
Yes.
And it seems to be that it doesn't take into account the dynamic nature of language, in a sense. Let's say, and it doesn't take into account extra linguistic dimensions in a social context. So it assumes that language is somehow fixed and isn't dynamic in a social interactive way. But so I'm just throwing this out. I don't know if it's true or not. So you could in a room, somebody says, "Well." And to understand that well, you have to introduce a whole load of other kind of extra linguistic elements.
Mm-hmm.
Tone, for example, tone of voice, what went on before, what the relationship is between the bodies in the room. I may be wrong, but it seems not to be able to deal with that kind of social discourse.
But it seems that, if we're dealing with Sanskrit, then it wouldn't necessarily have to.
I was thinking that. I think
it's
I don't think. Because even in social context, I have already said that the expressions are always culture specific. Okay. So, through ages, you found that the words are there. And usages of those words are there, and newer words are being produced also, and they are in use. Okay, so in case of linguistic behavior, the basic condition is it has to be known. It has to have knowability.
Mm-hmm.
Each and every referent has to be knowable. And on this factor, whenever whatever is being said in any context, in social, on religious, in personal, mental, in whichever context, it must release some sort of meaning through the way of abhidheyatva, that is verbalizability. That is, we experience and we verbalize. We cannot go beyond that. Okay, so if we make these two principles prevalent in our behavior, then you'll find there is nothing left out of this.
What about the creation of new words?
It always takes some meanings with it, because it the derivation, we derive the words taking from in our social behaviors like that, and make it a newer meaning to that. Nothing else. And even the single expressions like ha and ho, it gives different kinds of meaning where you are using it. Maybe in grief, maybe in joy.
And the system can deal with those kind of situations.
Yes, exactly. That's why this avachedakas are necessary. That is, they delimit things with the relations and their qualias or the properties like that, to reveal the exact meaning why you are using this word.
As opposed to some other term.
Yes.
During your lecture, you mentioned a few times the term artificial language.
Yes.
Could you say what you mean by that in this context?
Yes. Because this language has been instrumented methodologically, using it has its own terminology, as used in those coreferential terms I have shown you there, the contextual or referential terms. Those we do not often use in our natural language.
This is used by the philosophers then?
Yes,
the school.
Particularly the philosophers for the purpose of making debate and to do away with ambiguity. That means for non-ambiguous debate, creating a platform for non-ambiguous debate.
Well, let's take it up to 3 o'clock. It's a little time that we should stop. So thank you very much, Dr. Pallett, for a very interesting talk, and we look forward to you taking up this theme in future weeks. I'm still thinking about that social context.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for your patient hearing.
In a way, though, why should they have thought about social? I mean, that's only come into linguistics in the last 20, 30 years, hasn't it? The notion of sociolinguistics and social context. So why should we expect that of an ancient system?
I think the early Wittgenstein.
No, you'll find
this.
That this, had been this had been exercised in Indian tradition, in particularly in social context. You know the Dharma Shastras and Raghunatha, keeping on the Dharma Shastras in debate, particularly
Raghunatha,
yes. Through his commentaries on Dharma Shastras and forming a different school that is known as Bengal School of Dharma Shastras. That's only through this devised to Nabana language. He was a Nabanayayika.
This school is mainly in Bengal, is it?
Yes.
That Dharma Shastra tradition, is that the Dayabhaga? Who is it that wrote the Dayabhaga? Do you know that text, the Bengali law book?
Yes, Mithakshara and Dayabhaga.
Yeah.
So is that?
Yes. Yeah, okay.
And Dayabhaga was by Smartha Raghunandana, a pupil of Raghunatha.
Ah, he's a pupil of Raghunatha, I see.
And Mithakshara has been followed throughout India except Bengal, the eastern region.
Thank you.